you, and may it please the court. I think it's so important to begin with that the issue in this case is not whether there was probable cause for an arrest, but was there reasonable articulable suspicion for a temporary stop to confirm or dispel suspicion. And there's three pieces to the equation. Number one, the information the police had prior to July 19th, 2017. Two, the actions that the officers observed on that day. And three, sort of a subset, is the abrupt change in direction that Jenkins made when the police got out of the car and began to walk toward him. And all of these must be viewed together. The trial court found that the evidence failed ever so slightly to establish reasonable articulable suspicion, and that ruling was wrong. Certainly, the officers were not required to view illegal activity. And if we look at Terry versus Ohio, which both parties had discussed in their brief, and that really was the beginning point for reasonable suspicion for a Terry stop, the evidence in that case was not really as complete as in the case before the court, in that in the Terry case, the officer didn't have any information about Terry or his confederates before seeing them in the middle of the day walk back and forth in front of a store window. And knowing nothing, yes.
Tyson?
Yes.
Regarding the historical factors, well, I'll call them, and I know we view everything in the totality, but regarding those, in the discussion, the trial court seemed to, citing an argument made by Mr. Jenkins, that seemed to suggest that, you know, they were very nonspecific, no convictions, no actual, it was a lot of almost supposition, or somebody told somebody and nobody knew the real genesis of it. Given the standard of review and the light most favorable to Mr. Jenkins, does that diminish those factors in the analysis in any way?
I think, Your Honor, that, and obviously I understand that we're viewing the evidence in the light most favorable. And frankly, if all we had was just the information that Officer Porcell had before he saw anything happen on the 19th of July, we would be in a real tough spot. But what I do think is important is this. There's a lot of information. Yes, there's not a lot of specific information, and there aren't any arrests. But there's a lot of different information. There is evidence that Jenkins was involved in narcotics trafficking. Yes, he had field contacts, and there's not a lot of discussion about what that is, except that he's having contact with the police regarding narcotics. A confidential informant for Detective Bridges said he was selling narcotics within the month of July. There was and I think this is really important, in the system, not just from Detective Bridges, but in the records management system, there are alerts. And one of the alerts was contact Detective Bridges upon having contact with Jenkins. And there were things listed in the alerts of gang member, narcotics user, seller, probably armed, varmint. And what's important is the items that are in that system are used by the police officers not just to do their job, but to also be safe and remain safe. And so even though there's not evidence of a prior arrest for drugs, there is a lot of information, starting with Detective Bridges' investigation of the homicide, and that this particular individual was involved in either the acquisition or the disposal of a firearm in that homicide.
And I understand that, and I think that Judge Stuckles understood that. But that went more to, if you had reason to stop him, you had reason to pat him down, at least in the trial court's analysis. And to what extent are we limited, or do we need to defer to that portion of the trial court analysis?
Well, you know, I think that obviously the trial judge did note that if the stop was good, then certainly the pat down and the canine would be fine. But I think that in looking at the totality, and even in the light most favorable to the defendant, there is this element of criminality. And certainly the defense argument in this case, or the appellee's argument in this case, is that all of the activity was very innocent. And this innocent activity cannot support reasonable articulable suspicion. But when you have all of these various bits of information that are available to the police, I think that definitely that colors what you see. I think that it reminds me of I think it was a case where it colors what goes on the street corner. And I wish I had written down which case that was from. But when you have information, it colors what you see. And so we start out with I'm sorry?
Turning towards what I'll call the that day stuff. The observations of the officers.
Yes.
My understanding of the evidence is that he did not have a soda when he went into the convenience store, and he had a soda when he came out of the convenience store.
He certainly had one when he came out. I don't recall. I will defer to you if you saw that in the record. He definitely had a soda in his hand when he came out. Yes.
Does that undermine how suspicious it is that he went into the store, given the standard of review, like most favorable to him?
No, Your Honor, because as the court said in United States versus Arvizu and several other cases, the fact that there can be an innocent explanation does not preclude the finding of reasonable articulable suspicion. The fact
I understand that, but we have the trial court's finding, so we have the potential that the young person is a lookout. We have the potential that the older gentleman was a narcotics user looking to buy. What do we do with the fact that the trial court did not find this sufficient? If we truly view it in the light most favorable to the defendant, don't we have to conclude that that person is not a lookout?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because I don't think that the judge actually made those findings. There was a good deal of discussion between the prosecutor and the trial judge about, well, maybe he had cancer, maybe he was a parent. But I didn't read that as a ruling that this person was not, or that the officer was unreasonable in concluding, based on being there for 3 years, that this man had the appearance of being a narcotics addict. And so this is all going into the calculus that the officer, through his training, is entitled to make that determination. And, of course, he didn't say this man was a narcotics addict, but when he's looking at everything that's going on, this older man had the appearance of being a narcotics addict, and he travels with Mr. Jenkins to a place that's known to be used for the sale of narcotics when the police are in the neighborhood. They stay only a minute, and someone's outside appearing to act as a lookout, which is also consistent with the officer's experience being in that neighborhood, that there are, in these even control buys and other situations, that there are lookouts. And so the trial judge in this case just found that this didn't add up. And, in fact, the trial judge made a comment that if there had been a hand-to-hand transaction or maybe a throwdown, that it might be a different situation. I don't know that the judge made findings, and my opposing counsel can correct me if I'm wrong, that this person was not an addict or that the corner market was not a place that drugs are sold when police are in the neighborhood. I
agree with you that the judge made no formal findings of fact one way or the other on those questions. And don't we default to whatever implied findings of fact that are most helpful to the prevailing party, normally?
Well, absolutely, Your Honor, except in this case when the judge made the comment that if there had been a hand-to-hand transaction or if there had been a throwing down of some item, that would be something that would take it from ever so slightly not enough to be reasonable suspicion to over that hurdle. So I think given those comments of the judge, we're in a little bit different situation. We have a little bit more from the court with regard to the finding than we might have in some other case. And I think legally, we cited the cases, Branham, Morris versus City of Virginia Beach, those cases that really discuss what we're talking about with reasonable articulable suspicion. And let's remember that third part of the equation is the evasive action. It doesn't have to be headlong flight in Wardlow. The fact that this person made, and I believe it's on page 70 of the appendix, abruptly stopped and changed direction, attempted to go into the barbershop. So we have the information from before July 19th, the activity that the officer sees through his lens of experience of going into this Express Mart with the older apparent addict and the lookout on the outside. And then when the officers exit from their police car, the Jenkins makes an abrupt change to avoid them. Now, I realize that
the cases say that we're supposed to give due weight to the inferences drawn from the facts by the officers, but they also say we're supposed to do the same with the inferences drawn by local judges as well. Now, normally, that language appears in cases where the trial court has but mm-hmm. It seems to be the same standard applied. It appears there are conflicting inferences that have been drawn by the local officer and the local judge. What can we do with that?
Well, I believe it was when the judge began speaking and giving her ruling in this case, that she mentions not Monday morning quarterbacking the officers who are out there in the street, sort of the language from that U.S. versus Lender case about giving some respect to the officers who are out there every day. So I don't think that, given the fact that the trial judge made the finding that this was ever so slightly lacking, that she really rejected necessarily the inferences that the officers made. I think her ruling was a legal ruling, that it didn't meet the standard of reasonable suspicion. And that's really where the error is, because we're not talking about probable cause, where you might need to have a hand-to-hand transaction or something else that is more indicative of illegal behavior. But given the standard as in these cases, that's where the error lies here, as the judge found had too high of a bar for reasonable suspicion, which is for a Terry stop to dispel or confirm temporarily.
Ms. Tyson, you're now into your rebuttal time. You can do whatever you wish with it.
Your Honor, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I might, please.
All right. Ms. Thames.
Yes, Your Honor. May I please support Samantha Thames with the Richmond Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Jenkins on appeal. Respectfully, Your Honor, the Fourth Amendment still does require that, at minimum, police officers possess a reasonable articulable fact that give rise to reasonable suspicion of criminal activity before depriving a citizen of his or her privacy right and freedom of movement. And that must be more than just a hunch or a suspicion that criminal activity is afoot. And here, that behavior the officers observed on that day could not give rise to much more than a hunch that criminal activity was afoot. They simply saw Mr. Jenkins walking down a street, a public street in the city of Richmond, with two other men, go into a store with one of them, come back out, and keep walking. And the officers here did not take time to investigate. They did not watch Mr. Jenkins further or even stop the other two men or call in to other officers to have them be stopped. There simply was not enough here based off of that behavior to indicate that anything legal was going on at that time. And I will note that the officers did not see any of the behavior that the appellate courts have noted be suspicious. And I'm also saying this just by way of an example. And I do also think that that's what the trial court judge was saying, was that by way of an example, we don't see things such as hand-to-hand contact. We don't see bulges or an attempt to hide a bulge. We don't see Mr. Jenkins throw anything. We don't see Mr. Jenkins engage in any efforts to hide anything.
Are those things necessary?
No, sir, they are not necessary. And that's what, sorry.
Well, given that, do you agree that the trial court did not find, or at least gave no indication that it found, that any of the suppositions of the officer were per se unreasonable, that the young man was acting as a lookout, that the older gentleman appeared as if he could be a heroin purchaser?
I do agree that I think that the trial court in its ruling indicated that she took that, while she did not expressly say, I find him to be incredible, I do think the fact that she ruled in Mr. Jenkins' favor shows where she, that she believed that it was still an innocent behavior, and that because the officers did not see anything additionally, that she did inherently question what the officer was saying. And the fact is supposed to be viewed in the light most favorable to Mr. Jenkins.
If that's true, how could Judge Knuckles have found regarding both the pat down and the calling for the drug dog, how could she have found that those two things were reasonable if the stop were reasonable, if everything that the police officer testified to that point was incredible?
I don't believe that she, I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I possibly misspoke. I believe that in that ruling, what she is indicating is that what he had up to that point was not enough to justify the stop. I think that what we have here, and I think what she continues to emphasize, is exactly how little information that the officer had at that point about as far as, you know, I will quote the trial court on page 90. He has some information he's reading. He has no idea from who he's reading it, and that there is engaging in activity consistent with drug dealing. We don't know if it's hand-to-hand because it's criminal information. Not knowing nothing about it, just suspected activity. I think that what she is indicating with all of this is that at that point, because they had not seen anything and because this information they have is tenuous, there was not enough reason to stop him, and that it failed at that point to have to provide a reason to stop him. But I do think that she was, I don't know the exact parameters of what exactly she said at that point, but I do think that was more focused upon what the results of the pat down would have been, and that at that point, so they were allowed to call the drug dog, Your Honor. But I think that the trial court was very clear in granting Mr. Jenkins' motion to suppress that it simply was not enough at that point to justify them stopping him. The behavior was simply not enough. I think she was citing by way of example that we don't have what we have in other cases, such as hand-to-hand transactions, bulges, things like that, that this court has said to be indicia of illegal behavior. And the information that the officers had, while there are multiple notes in that file, they're also very tenuous notes. And I would argue that given how tenuous the information is, the officers were under an obligation to continue to investigate before they did detain him and deprive him of his Fourth Amendment rights.
In making that conclusion that it wasn't enough, in doing that, was the trial judge making a legal conclusion that based on what the officer observed, or was the trial judge making a factual conclusion?
Your Honor, I do believe that it was probably a mixed answer, Your Honor. I think that she is making a legal conclusion based off the fact she was presented that it was not enough under reasonable suspicion standards.
Didn't she actually say, this is the Commonwealth's best case, if I credit all of this, it's not enough?
Yes, sir. She did list and made a point to list off everything that the Commonwealth had. And I also would note, Your Honor, that while I understand and I heard the court say that you don't find in the record to find that she actually made an evidentiary finding about him not being a drug addict, there was a, during that conversation with Ms. Floyd, I believe it was on, I'm sorry, if I may, there was
it's
a
in your
note
brief.
That there was no, yes, there is no evidence to support what she is saying about him being a drug addict. I do think that the court should take that to be a factual finding, that there was no evidence. It wasn't merely a conversation with them, is that she found there was no evidence to support this conclusion that he, that other older man was a drug addict. I would like to point that out to the court as well. But here, I simply would argue that there wasn't enough here to stop him. The behavior is innocent. The fact that he was in a high crime neighborhood should not imbue everything that he is doing in that neighborhood with criminality. The alerts on the system were one from criminal informants where it was not clear from the record and even from the court asking the officer himself where that information was really coming from, what kind of contacts they were. It was simply criminal informants with no additional information. So while there were these hits on the pistol system. There simply was not enough behavior for those officers to stop him at that point, because it was simply just quickly not enough, Your Honor, under this court standard. I will also argue that Thompson should control in this case. As Thompson, while I do understand that Thompson focused on the second element of Terry, whereas armed and dangerous in his final ruling, the facts are very clearly the same as this case, and I think that the analysis could and should be applied to this case as well, where Mr. Thompson was found to be loitering, as the officer said, in an open-air market for drugs. And based off that officer's experience as well, that location is used for drug sales, where loitering was featured heavily in those sales. The officer watched him for a number of moments, and when the officer approached, Mr. Thompson and his patriots attempted to walk away. That is extremely similar to what we have here, where the officer is testifying that in his training experience in this area, people do use stores or just generally alleys, anywhere they can duck to engage in drug sales. But yet, the court
in Thompson, there was none of what I have called the historical data, though. Vague as it may have been, there was no suggestion that Mr. Thompson had any prior contacts with police involving drug transactions.
No, sir, there was not. But the other elements were there, where a gentleman was seen engaging in behavior that the officer testified in his training experience was consistent with drug dealing and an attempt to walk away. And in that case, the court also noted that the appellant had no obligation to answer the officer's questions. And it is clear under the case law that the officers, that general citizens do not have an obligation to engage with police officers or answer their questions as long as it's still, you know, at that point, a consensual encounter. So he had no obligation to continue to walk towards those officers at that point. But I also do not believe that his decision to not walk towards the officers should be read by this court to amount to reasonable suspicion to detain him and pat him down. There simply is not enough here to justify detaining Mr. Jenkins. He was seen walking down the street with two men. He was seen going into a store. He was seen coming out of the store. At a certain point, there was a soda in his hand. He had nothing in his other hand. The record is very clear about that. There simply was not enough here to detain him. If the officer, and the court also knows in Thompson that the officer there did not do anything to develop the additional facts during the course of the encounter to support reasonable suspicion. And here, too, the officers did nothing to further develop their reasonable suspicion in this case. They simply stopped him and detained him. And at that point, they did not have enough to do so. So we would maintain that the trial court did not err in her ruling and that the court should maintain her ruling and suppress the evidence in this case. Your Honors, we also will note that this court does not have jurisdiction over this case because of the notice of appeal that was not properly filed under the statute. As the court is aware, under 19.2-400, no appeal shall be allowed to the Commonwealth pursuant to subsection A of 19.2-398 unless within 7 days after the entry of the court order, the Commonwealth files a notice of appeal. And in this case, the order from the bench came from on 131. The order granting it came on 221, but the notice was filed on 27. And this court, the trial court see through their written orders, and the order was not actually signed or entered into until after the notice was filed. So under a clear, a strict reading of the statute, this notice appeal was filed improperly.
Let me ask you about that. Rule 5A6, which is also incorporated into the statute, if not inconsistent, does not change when something is due, but it creates a deeming rule for appeals filed before the order is entered. And just as for any appeal noted before the written order is entered, we will deem it filed on the day that the order is entered.
Yes, sir.
If the deeming rule applies, the notice was timed, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but we will maintain that it does not apply because of the structure that the General Assembly gave to the statute, and specifically detailing out the deadline filing followed by the affidavit requirement, and then the other requirements are guided by the rules. And if you look to the rules, the deadline for normal filings, for lack of a better word, or defendant filings, is included in the same subsection of Rule 5A6 as that extension rule. So I do think that it was carved out, and I think they are separate and apart. And I don't think that that it should be read together in that way. I think that the General Assembly was explicit in what they were granting to the Commonwealth, as the general right to appeal is only guided by the statute on purpose. And the General Assembly did not expressly did not include that same pro-dating or backdating clause as the Supreme Court has granted to general appellants. Moreover, the notice here is not sufficient because of under cases such as Commonwealth v. Du Bois, it does not, this court would have to actually look to the record to determine if there was more than one motion to suppress granted based off of first denied or heard.
Let me ask you about that. In Du Bois, Judge Petty's opinion makes a big deal about there could have been multiple hearings with multiple motions to suppress, and in fact, it doesn't even tell us really what, if anything, it wants to do. It just says 398A2. Here, the notice notes that it seeks to reverse the trial court's ruling suppressing evidence, and it specifically says in the notice that the hearing date, I think it refers to it as the court date, was January 31st, 2018. So why doesn't that put everybody on notice that whatever evidence was suppressed by the trial court at the hearing on January 31st, 2018 is what we're talking about?
Because there could have been multiple motions to suppress heard on that day as well, Your Honor. This court would have to look through the record to see how many were filed. And while
why wouldn't it cover all evidence suppressed on January 31st, 2018? Whether there's one motion, two motions, six motions, it just says all the evidence suppressed on that hearing date is what we're challenging.
Yes, sir. And we would simply maintain that the court would still have to review the record to see precisely which decisions and which aspects of that the Commonwealth was, in fact, appealing. So between the two, both the timing of the filing as well as the included in the filing, we maintain that this court does not have jurisdiction over this matter, but ask the court to dismiss it. And unless there is any other questions, I do believe that we maintain that the trial court did not err. There simply was not enough evidence in this case for the officer to reasonably that criminal activity was afoot from Mr. Jenkins simply walking down the street in the city of Richmond in a high crime area, as hundreds, if not thousands of people live in that area, walk down that street, go to stores on that street. There simply is not enough here for the police officers to have stopped and detained him and deprived him of Fourth Amendment rights at that time. So we'd ask the court to maintain Judge Knuckle's ruling in this case.
Thank you very much. Your time has expired. Ms. Tyson, I believe you have 2 minutes and 43 seconds, if my count is correct.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will address the notice of appeal, the timeliness of the notice of appeal. I think that argument is refuted by Du Bois because the judge in that case actually referred to 5A6 and how the notice did not. There were two notices in Du Bois, the one that was filed before the order was entered and one filed after. That case was not dismissed because the order was filed before the order was entered. It was dismissed because the early order was insufficient and the later order wasn't signed. If you look at Du Bois, it refutes the argument, and I think that in statutory construction this would lead to an absurd result because the Commonwealth is expeditiously and diligently moving the case along, which is the goal of a Commonwealth appeal. And the notice was sufficient. It contained enough information for the court to know precisely the issue that was being appealed and the case. Back to the issues, I would note that Thompson didn't just focus on the pat-down, that Thompson is limited to discussing the pat-down and other discussion is dictum in that case. Additionally, there was much more evidence in our case than loitering. Secondly, on page 107 is the discussion of the appendix is the discussion about cancer. And the prosecutor argued that it would appear that he was a drug addict, and the court says, or he has cancer. The prosecutor said, but we don't have any evidence of that. And the court says, we don't have any evidence of what you're saying either, but anyway. I think that is not a finding that this was not someone who appeared to be a drug addict by the trial court. I would note again that in Terry, there was no illegal activity. These people, I believe this court in Shiflett said, referred to them as overeager shoppers. That's about the information, but based on what the officer knew and through his lens of experience, then the overeager shoppers did give him reasonable suspicion, and that indeed it was a legal finding by the court in this case that there was not reasonable suspicion. That is an incorrect finding, and this court should reverse the judgment of the Circuit Court of the City of Richmond.
Thank you, Ms. Tyson. You almost hit the buzzer exactly on the nose. That's impressive without a light system. Thank you both for your argument. If there are no questions from my co-judges, we will retire in the conference.
I have no question. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your arguments.